Fear as a principle of social organization. Fear nukes. 1953, duck, cover, crawl under your desk. The same desk where you carve your name and have to stay after school for a week, sanding it by hand under the teacher's ice pick eye. Learn fear. Fear father. When your father comes home, Mommy, will Daddy be in a good mood? You understand why I must punish you, that this hurts me more than you? Daddy, please. Love fear. Fear God. He sees you, knows when you cheat, when you touch yourself, when you think your dirty little thoughts about Susie. He's a bit like Santa Claus, only real, and he can make you go to hell. Worship fear. Fear acne. Fear wearing dumb shoes, cliques, being left out, getting turned down for dates, for a part in the play, being the last one chosen for softball or soccer. Fear showing you care. Fear yourself. Fear sex, fear girls, fear women, fear boys, fear hairy palms, syphilis, wet dreams, not knowing how to undo a bra, sweaty hands, coming too soon, not coming. Fear desire, fear getting a job, fear losing it, not knowing the right word, saying the wrong thing, gossip and office intrigue, drug tests, the boss, fear candor, fear secrecy, fear everyone. Fear aging, fear skin growing slack, joints getting stiff, eyes weak, desire limp, thought thick, memory thin, fear nothing to do, fear loneliness, fear... And I always like to read some poems by other poets, and I got a couple here from Central America. I spent a lot of time in Nicaragua during the 80s, during the revolution, and translated a lot of Nicaraguan poetry. This is by another poet of my generation, Luis Rocha. It's called Class Distinction. And since we have class warfare in this country now, I think it's time that we all understood this terminology. In my beloved Nicaragua, according to the words of a poet, we've only two classes of people. Those who eat shit, and those who dine on it. The shit eaters are those of us who have, for the moment, no other choice. The others are those who have the choice not to, but choose to anyway, and eat it with gusto. If you meditate deeply on so elemental a definition of our national banquet, you will arrive at the happy conclusion that in our country there certainly is a sharp distinction between the classes. And this is one you may actually know. It's a poem of Leonel Rugama, who was a Nicaraguan poet who was killed in the by the Contras. It's called The Earth is a Satellite of the Moon. No, he was killed by Somoza Guardia before the triumph of the revolution. So The Earth is a Satellite of the Moon by Leonel Rugama. Okay. Apollo 2 cost more than Apollo 1, and Apollo 1 cost plenty. Apollo 3 cost more than Apollo 2, Apollo 2 cost more than Apollo 1, and Apollo 1 cost plenty. Apollo 4 cost more than Apollo 3, Apollo 3 cost more than Apollo 2, Apollo 2 cost more than Apollo 1, and Apollo 1 cost plenty. Apollo 8 cost a hell of a lot. But nobody cared because the astronauts were Protestants and read the Bible from the moon, and all the Christians marveled and exulted, and when they returned, Pope Paul VI gave them a blessing. Apollo 9 cost more than all of them put together, including Apollo 1, which cost plenty. The great-grandparents of the people of Acahualinca were not as hungry as the grandparents. The great-grandparents died of hunger. The grandparents of the people of Acahualinca were not as hungry as the parents, and the grandparents died of hunger. The parents of the people of Acahualinca were not as hungry as the children of the people there, and the parents died of hunger. The people of Acahualinca are not as hungry as their children are. Their children never see the light of day for hunger. Yet they have a hunger to be born, to die of hunger. Blessed are the poor, for they shall inherit the moon. Mm. This is a poem that came from a journey. I sailed across the Atlantic on a little 37-foot sailboat with three other people. And I learned to navigate using a sextant by the stars. And we had a GPS thing on the boat, but we never used it. We wanted to see whether we could do a Columbus number, and we did. And this is the sextant. Many times I told how that night was my turn to read the stars, how I steadied the sextant in my hand an hour before dark and read the sun, two stars, angle and incident, went below to tables and math, came on deck, announced tomorrow at 10 we see land. How in the morning at 9:45 I climbed the mast and hung there swinging in long arcs port and starboard across the deck 40 feet below. How I cursed the smoke or fog that lay like a cat on the horizon. How I finally thought, not smoke, not fog. No, it must be. And shouted, land ho, land ho, and swung dancing down the rope. Only now, two decades after, do I understand it was not my accomplishment so excited me, but the thrill of finding there are limits to push against and just where they should be that set me dancing with the air, that we can trust the universe that we are a part of. And this is a poem, it's called a piropo. Does anybody a Spanish speaker in here?
Isn't that the poems of flirtation?
Yes. Yeah. It's a poem. They're little rhymes that young men make up and whisper in young women's ears as they pass them going different directions around the Zócalo, the square. I'll read it first in Spanish because it came to me in Spanish. Ahí vienes bailando un sueño de agua, tus ojos, luz de estrellas, brincantos sobre el mar, ondeas, burbujeas, líquida como el amor, y con la voz de un riachuelo en la montaña derramas sonrisas. Ay, que fuese yo piedra donde vos fluyas sobre mí, acariciándome millones de años, y siempre fragmentos de mí traías con vos, hasta que yo sea perdido por completa en vos, y vos sos, yo soy vos. And this one is macaronic. It's a little bit of Spanish, mostly English. Here you come, bailando, dancing. Un sueño de agua, a dream of water. Your eyes, starlight, dancing on sea waves. Balbuceas, you bounce up and down. Ondeas, you wave. Liquid as love. Y tu voz, and your voice, la voz of a mountain rill, spilling sonrisas, smiles. Ay, que fuese yo piedra, oh, if I were only a stone, so you would flow over me, acariciándome, caressing me, millions of years, and every year, fragmentos de mí se van con vos, will go with you, until I am perdido, lost, completely within you, y vos sos yo, soy vos, and you are, I am you. Decided today to read old poems, so you may have heard some of these before. This one's called Deep Grammar. I read some Noam Chomsky. I usually read his political stuff, but I read some linguistic stuff. And he has this theory that that there is something called deep syntax, deep grammar, that we are born with. And that if any of you have had children, you know that they spend a couple of years just saying nonsense. And then suddenly, they make a complete sentence that nobody's ever said before. And where does that come from? And Chomsky says that's hardwired into our brains by a series of mutations. So this is deep grammar. Take this fern by the dark root, the color of a word before language, burning from brown to red as it burrows up toward light, to burst green in a great arc, flinging stems out in shallower arcs, shooting out leaves and the leaves growing fingertip fringes delicate as thought. No telling from their elegant coiffure what shape the ground is beneath. On their undersides they swell to spores, pop to propagate more of their kind, like but quite apart in root and ground. They arc up by thousands from the forest floor. Fern fans, perfect as sentences, subject and act suspended under the trees. This is the first death poem I ever wrote. They're getting more frequent now. This was a couple of decades ago. It's called Guest. He moves in when the house is built, sleeps in the spare room or cadges in the garage, is not particular about cleanliness, though clean enough, needs no place at table. So we forget he's here. He's gone to mill. But one day, looking for an old box of toys or a half-remembered overcoat, troubled by a mote in the corner of an eye, we turn and get a nasty shock. He's there still. In time, we take him along on outings, invite him to sit in the kitchen and the living room, talk to him on winter nights, grow companionable in his silence. And then his time comes, and it turns out he's the developer who's bought the place to tear it down. But he's not in a hurry. Quiet as a ghost and secure in his power, he is the perfect patient host. Arranges food and drinks, what there is to think of, he thinks, and the house will sport black crepe and white flowers, his compliments, after he takes possession. And he teaches us at last to know ourselves by whether we think him too soon or late or in good time. Well, here's another death poem. This was from the mid-1980s. Remember Bobby Sands? He was an Irish Republican Army soldier who was captured in Northern Ireland and imprisoned in Lunkesh prison. And he was one of the original hunger strikers, and he stuck it out to the end. He died. He starved to death. Bobby Sands. His mute face spoke more than the use we put it to. Beside the gluttony of guns, beside the bomb's racket, beside the prisoned hunger of his flesh, we knew our slogans were nothing to the visage on our placards, and animals or flowers, and his act was hard as stone, for we could shout together, but in the maze he was alone. Lunkesh was called the maze. How often, after the 40th day, after the 50th, we said, no, no human will allow this. Thatcher will stop it. And she did not, too busy with this and that, or too convinced he had it coming. Until there was no hurry, he died May 8th, 1981, at Lunkesh Maze Prison, Belfast, after 67 days refusing food. Bobby's body's every cell turned ravening harpy, a hive of mouths devouring one another, gorging pell-mell, till at the end pain was all he housed. Still incomprehensible, the end of breath, even after so much busy death. A life poem. This is a poem to another poet, or about another poet, a Guatemalan poet named Ana Maria Rodas, and I've translated a lot of her poetry. Nobody's ever wanted to publish it. It's incredibly feminist poetry, and nobody wants to publish it in this country. I don't know why. For Ana Maria Rodas. She told me once that I asked her, how did you start writing poetry? Because she was a journalist, newspaper reporter. And she said, I had to. If I hadn't started writing poetry, I would have killed either myself or my husband. For Ana Maria Rodas, she has thrown down the words of her anger like stones, and now she walks across them, saying them aloud. She picks them up again, sets them revolving in bright air. If she did not do this, she would die. She might be killed for doing it anyway. Defying gravity sets a bad example. She speaks, takes her love out of hiding. This is how the long war is won. Back in 2000, I was headed to Boston to take a workshop with Martina Spada. And the night before I left New York in Penn Station, I was taking like a 1 o'clock in the morning train, something like that. This is called First Lesson, Penn Station, 2 a.m. I guess it was a 3 o'clock train. The Northeast Direct is delayed an hour. Tomorrow, I'll sit among 100 other poets, each of us digging into our bags of words, to show each other our collections, broken toys, burnt offerings, shells and stones. Tonight, though, waiting for the train, I sit alone, my baggage round my feet. Across the waiting room aisle, a tall, twig-thin man uses his walking stick to tell stories to two children and their skeptical father. He dances the stick in the air. It becomes rabbit, mole, eagle, bear. Now it's a river, then a mountain, and the stag leaping up it, pursued by a leopard, the leopard by a man, the man by his own microbes and dust. The younger child asks, "How come you got bandages on your leg, and how come you wear a glove on that hand?" The glove on his right hand is black. The white bandages neatly wrap his right leg, thigh to ankle. "Well, one part of me is happy and smart," he says. "The other half is sick." "Does it hurt?" asks the older child. "Yes, it does, but I pay it no mind. This is what I love to do, talk with the little people. That's what keeps me well." He places his stick in their hands, shows them how to hold it, swing it, shake it. He stories it into a snake, a butterfly, a grandfather clock with an evil ancestor as a pendulum, then gently lifts it from them and it becomes a cloud of minas, quetzals, mallards, flamingos, cardinals, snow owls, each bearing a human soul to another dimension where they will get another chance. "Little people, thank you for listening." The boy slaps five with the too tall, too thin man, and the man takes the girl's hand, gazes into her eyes, pronounces a blessing their father strains to hear, straightens, leans on his stick, and walks erect and stiff to the exit. Well, this is a really old one here. You stop me when I've gone too far. Because I didn't look at my clock. This is for Henry Dumas. Do you all know who Henry Dumas was?
Yeah.
He was one of the leaders of the Black Arts Movement in the late 50s. You'll see what happened to him in the poem.
Chris, let's say 5 minutes.
Okay. For Henry Dumas. "Tonight, your friends said your words aloud, and all that spoke through you came out of their mouths, made their hands jump, fly, point, punch, caress us in an intimate dance of head and heart to your words' beat. On the subway back downtown, your words still drum in my belly and heart, rain cotton and valentines, revel in their own accent, and dance through tunnels in old overalls, in tweed jackets, in robes of bright color, and naked as water. Exulting at finding you, I turn the page to find again a bullet, a cop, a face as white as mine, and you shot dead at a Harlem subway stop, a case of mistaken identity. I'm holding the book your fellow griots have made of your 34 years, stroking its cover like a lover's face before a long absence, and my face is not my own. We'll never hear now how you'd have told about that subway stop or ever stopped that bullet from taking you off. But your songs and the space where your heart went still will hold us all." I drove a cab in New York in the 70s. Hack at 2 a.m. Rain splashes the downtown FDR, taillights, headlights, street lamps up the ramp. Lower East Side tenements, projects gleam, flip on the off-duty sign. Do you pick this guy up hopping out of the bodega on Avenue D where 3/4-inch plexi surrounds everything but the door? Not this time, buddy. You're buying lahais here. You've either got your ride or you're trouble, and I'm not buying. Talk to the street. Talk back to the radio. Not much chance of a fire. Who likes to talk? Of a fare, who likes to talk at this hour? Head east on 3rd, take a right on 1st, left on 9th. No point in speed or destination, and how you get there, you leave to whim and chance and the taxi gods. Still, your head ching-chings, registering cash. How much for me, how much for the garage, and when can I go home to sleep? Okay, let me do one more. Which one here? All right, Manhattan Pier. This was over on the west side before the beautiful park and bikeway was put in. Manhattan Pier. One cloud floats over Jersey, about 20 degrees up, eclipsing the sun. Must be some trick of its hidden mass casts its own shadow shape among the sun rays. Even cloud-shrouded, the sun is hard to look at. The cloud core, a rich gray. But its perimeter puffs out incandescent silver, blinding. Below, a single rooftop in Newark gleams, and lower yet, a strip of river. The cloud moves. The earth moves faster, slower than the cloud. Sun stain begins to spread, begins to reach, slowly reaches faster, then all the way across the lordly, straight for me. The whole wide river sparkles and glitters, and two rowers kayak across the sun road, almost lost in so much light. And this poem has begun to form. I recall a young genius at school when we were all young geniuses, calling such a moment privileged. I wonder, would not an egret see it differently, and a bargeman too, perhaps as a hindrance to the job at hand, fishing or navigation? And then, whose privilege? And what if the cloud had been 10 degrees higher, or not there at all? Would this have been any less a sunset over Jersey? The only privilege here is that I'm out of work and have the time to watch. I'd ask another, though, that a moment like this one be my last, for this is how I'd like to go, over water into expanding light. Wow. Thank you so much.
Suzanne, you're publishing fiction and plays, right?
Am I
correct? Okay. So, and you're hosting the Sunday night fiction reading at the KGB Red Room.
That's correct.
Okay. So, please welcome Suzanne Dottino, who will read for about 20 minutes. And
should I put a chair there, or what is the?
Whatever will work for you. Whatever you need.
What? It's good enough. Yeah.
Here? Okay, all right, let's take it. Okay. Okay, so I'm reading a piece, and it's called Lowe's Views of Her Mother Weeping. Okay. A hoity-toity man with a small dog in his lap was driving a red Cadillac with thick white walls and a gash of silver chrome on the hood. He ran over my mother.
That's not funny.
I let my lace curtains fall in front of my bedroom window. I took a bite of my apple, readjusted my glasses, and flipped through the pages of my Movies, Movies, Movies magazine. I looked in the mirror and pulled my hair back into a ponytail. I went to my dresser and took out my training bra, a pair of red shorts and a white tank top with clusters of yellow flowers embroidered on the neckline. I laid them on my bed. I lifted my pink nightie up over my head, but stopped midway. I stood still facing my bedroom window. I was trying to think of why, for what reason, how had my mother died? Oh, yes, she was run over by a red Cadillac with thick white walls and a gash of silver chrome on the hood. I walked down the stairs trying to occupy the least amount of space possible by inhaling myself away. And when that didn't work, I imagined my flesh to be as see-through as the skin of a taut white grape, and that my blood was drained of its red blood cells so that it was clear like water and flowed through a network of transparent tube-like veins that were entwined over and around my glass bones bones that were glued together with Elmer's glue that had dried clear. I made it halfway down the stairs when Hans Jobe Duval, our house guest with the funny French accent, happened to be going up the same time I was going down, rammed into me. I placed my right hand on the banister to base myself in the here and now. I told him about my mother's death. As I spoke, two distinct things happened simultaneously. A light went out, pow, in his head, and a light went on, pop, in his eyes. He appeared to be scanning my mind for the appropriate response. The first was happy. His lips parted and curled upwards. Happy. I frowned. He quickly shifted his response to sad by curling his lips downward. He even said, sadly, your mother dying was the best thing. Her general ennui had bellowed and barked, petered and plots, so to speak. It never occurred to me that my mother might be better off, yet I didn't care to head him off at the pass. I made fish lips at him and then told him that I, too, supposed it was the best things. Always had. So there. As time drew on, I went into deep wonder about that smile of his and also that pop and that pow. I wondered, quite frankly, if he had something to do with my mother's demise and my fate for her future as well. I wondered, too, if I should keep my eye out for that fellow figure of a farther than feels fatherly, that fellow with a French accent who roamed delicately behind me as I drifted from room to room, up the stairs and down the stairs. I closed the door to my bedroom, sat at the edge of my bed, and unwrapped a pink square of soft chewing gum. I plopped the cherry-flavored morsel in my mouth and began to chew away. Clip, snap, crack, clip, snap, crack. I drenched the trickle-turned flow of flavorful juices out immediately and proceeded to blow large, larger, and finally largesse bubbles. With my elbow bent and my chin digging into my palm, I stared out my window and into my backyard. I lowered my heart-shaped sunglasses to see straight through the sun's glare and wavering glaze without the aid of the shades and concluded that yes, it simply was not possible that it was my mother on the swing in our piazza out back and weeping. My mother was dead. It could be my school teacher, the librarian, my clarinet teacher, the crossing guard, or who knows. Although, under close inspection, that woman on the swing did resemble my mother. I felt particularly drawn to the possibility that she was merely an impression of my mother and not the real thing. However, her tears dispelled that thought, and I had fond thoughts of our moments together as mother and daughter when we drove and bickered our way to Hourglass Lake. My mother forgot to apply sunscreen to her face that day, and she suffered sunburn. She wept. Even then, she was a weeper. As I looked closer at the weeping woman in the piazza, I saw that she resembled the weeping woman with the sunburn. The two matched up. Poor things. I'd have offered her my copper tone, but she was over there, and I was over here. If I wanted it more, a little grease could have kept her safe from harm. The sun wouldn't have burned her, and so we'd all have smiled and laughed and sung and danced. It was someone's mother on that swing set. That much was clear. She was motherly. That was something one couldn't help but take notice of. She had the disillusioned, sorrowful glint in her eyes that is so commonly worn by mothers. She wore a white apron that had a silver whisk, a red tomato, and a stalk of green celery stitched and scattered across the bib section. My mother's tears streamed down her cheeks and left small, languid puddles at the base of her swing set. Her body hunched over and convulsed as she wept and wept and wept. Her muscular sobs caused the swing to sway back and forth, to and fro. Mean metronome. She was sobbing in time with her pain, which, as one was meant to see, painful. But yet again, maybe it was not my mother who was weeping out there. Perhaps it was Allison's mom or Laura's, or maybe it was H's mom visiting from France. As I stretched out on my bed, someone was a knock, knock, knocking on my door. It was Hans. He entered with both arms high in the air and said, "Lo and behold," as if he didn't know who and where I was. I was propped myself up on my pillow and wiggled three fingers from my back of my head and said, "Me no like that you pretend you don't know me. Me is Lo, and you, sir, you know what it is and not a no-no. Did you kill my mother?" The instant I said the M word, it sounded vulgar, vile, rude, and repulsive. I was worked into a haze. I wanted to stop my verbal interrogation with Hans' mom right then and there, when lo and behold, he put his fingers over my mouth and told me to Hush, hush. He prattled a song in my ear while balancing me on his lap. A few seconds later, or perhaps it was longer, like I said, I was in a haze, I stood up and flattened out the wrinkles down the front of my frock. My face was hot and flushed with my smile, dreamy. I sauntered off into the bathroom. Now that was interesting, positively interesting. Where, oh where, oh my, oh dear, oh, 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 and there she is, there is my mother. She's swinging in the chair in the piazza, and she is weeping. I will do something. Some bonbons, Mama? Some intellectual journals? Her heart is exploding. My heart is exploding. She looks off to one side and extends her hands out in front of her. She needs me, but why only now? Now that she is there and I am here. How could this be? How did we get this way? Have I gotten in the way? What has wounded you, Mommy? You, your moo-moo? A collagen injection? Is it my bobby socks? My sharp tongue? Yes, that must be it. I'll cut out my tongue. I'll go the long haul. I'll take the high road. I'll throw myself in front of a roaring train. I'll drown in a sea of your tears. I'll starve to death, etc. I'll wait for a sign from my mother. If it was my mother, she'll show me a sign. Oh, look, my mother was throwing some of her prized knickknacks in the air and waiting for them to fall. Very French. It was on a Friday. Khan said to me as he swung his tennis racket up and back over his head. Duh, I said as I lopped back his serve. I let go of my grip on the racket and wiped the sweat from my palm on the back of my white trunks. He let the ball whir past me. Wake up, I screamed. He winced. Your mother, well, you see, his voice trailed as he fumbled with the yellow fluorescent ball he had taken from his white trousers. I'm not over it, if that's what you think, I said, hands on my hips. Hans walked to the net. He leaned sideways and propped himself up with the racket as though it were a cane. On Friday, your mother was not well, dear. Your mother had been taken to walking on lines, so to speak, hence her tragic ending. Now, I don't suppose you ever found the driver of that audacious sedan, did you? Well, I did, and he reported that your mother was witnessed under the wheels of the parked aforementioned sedan and had slashed them violently with her nail file. I started the car and ran her over. Fini! Hans flicked his wrist in the air, pulled out his handkerchief, and wiped his glistening forehead. So it was you. You murdered her. In the piazza, there was my mother's swing. In it sat my mother. She wore an attitude similar to that of a dead Indian chief. Her face coveted a gentle smile, careworn eyes, and her hands were crossed delicately on her lap. For a millisecond, I was drawn in and back to a time when I sat at the edge of her bed. It happened just once. She had brown clay drying on her face, a beauty mask. Also on her bed were little teacups and saucers borrowed from my old dollhouse. She was having a tea party. I quietly closed the door, sea green door, with the number 16 written smack in the middle of it. I placed my suitcase down, whipped out my shades, and noted that the black car with the darkened windows with whiskey-colored license plates was parked right next to us in the parking lot of the Harmony Hotel for Conscientious Travelers in 29 Palms, California. I flicked off my sneakers and peeled off my white anklets. The darkened window rolled down halfway, where all I could see was the outline of a cowboy hat. I looked back to our room and then back to the hat that was raised up from the dark head and tipped in my direction. With my suitcase in hand, I walked to the road and walked and walked and walked and walked. I walked on the shady side of the street, set my bag down, and then waited. For what? I didn't know. I put on strawberry lip gloss. I thought about what I was going to do, but what was it? What was I going to do? Oh yes, I won't look back. My mother is looking at herself in the mirror. She is wearing a short skirt, pink taffeta, on which there is a number of yellow yield signs, red stop signs, and black tire tracks embroidered throughout. From behind her false eyelashes, she asks, how do I look? I, too, am in the mirror, and I am looking at her. Hi, Mommy, you're back. I am wearing a short skirt that is black cotton pleated. I turn my body profile, tilt my head down, and frown at my drooping breasts. I place my hands on my stomach that has swelled into a balloon. Well, my mother asks impatiently. Look like you are looking. That's how you look, I say happily. Oh, and there is Hans. Hans is in the mirror, too, and he is looking at all three of us there in the mirror. He's wearing a brown linen suit, a tan cashmere vest, and cream-colored shirts. He pulls a white handkerchief out from his pocket and waves it in the air. Truce, he says. My mother and I walk out of the mirror, weeping. I turn back at Hans and look at him fondly and wave. I am walking backwards, but in step with my mother. I wave at Hans and tell him, too late, mister.
Finis?
That's it.
Okay. Robert, you write both fiction and memoir, right? Am I wrong?
Sort of. No, right. Totally right.
All right. Well, anyway, I guess a lot of you...
Chris's poem is the fear of going first, fear of going second, and fear of going third. So the fear of going third head on here. Okay. Each one is very different for me. Okay. So I'm just going to start with a very short little scene where a friend of mine was telling me about his work situation. Mark used to regale Pete and me with stories from his days working in a gay bathhouse. He would not reveal the names of any of the patrons, particularly politicians, even those closeted anti-gay legislators who were patrons. He told me a story once of a father and son, neither knowing the other was gay, accidentally meeting in the bathhouse. Panic struck, they ducked for cover, poking their heads out of various hiding places as they tried to see where the other one was. The whole bathhouse got into the act. Men from everywhere jumped out of cubicles and stalls, attempting to coax them from their hiding places. Negotiations of the highest order were held. Finally, father and son emerged to a crescendo of cheers as they tentatively made their way to a dramatic and successful face-to-face encounter. When the bathhouse closed, the unemployment office did not try to make Mark find a comparable job. The Museum. Story 1. I went with my friend Miriam to the Guggenheim Museum. It was to one of those huge exhibits that draws thousands of people. Allen Ginsberg was there responding, taking it all in. There was a lightness and intensity in his response to the work. Miriam rented a headset with a tape that walked her through the exhibit. She was unfamiliar with the work. I didn't know the work, and I didn't order the headset. Subtext. Allen Ginsberg, world famous poet. An artist, philosopher, photographer, Buddhist, political activist, middle-aged Jew, homosexual. Responding to, connected to, breathing with, continuous with the works on display. He wouldn't be bogged down by headphones, which either were going to tell him things he already knew, and if he didn't, would interfere with his reactions by superimposing a grid through which he would see the work. Miriam is a linguist, in the beginning of a career that has moved her into something like the third tier of fame in international academic circles. A feminist, a Jew, she has a deep alertness. She has powerful responses to music, art, literature, etc. She didn't want to take in the work in ignorance. It allowed her the freedom to have a response. Okay. Me, I was caught up in the sense of myself as a great artist who doesn't need an uptight academic guide on tape. But I had no idea what I was saying. Nothing to help me have an orientation. I wanted to be like Ginsberg. But he was free. Miriam took care of herself. I succumbed to ignorance. Story 2. I went with my mother and father to the Guggenheim Museum. It was to one of those huge exhibits that draws thousands of people. My mother walked me through the exhibit, explaining things to me about the painters and the paintings. I knew one or two of the people who had also come to the museum. One was a quite famous, sensitive left-wing writer and psychoanalyst. My father sat on a bench, looked at the paper, and then dozed off as parts of the Sunday Times hung from his lap. Subtext. My mother was my guide. In fact, that is what she did two times a week. She worked at the Guggenheim as a volunteer. One of her jobs was walking people around and giving talks on the various exhibits. To see my mother possess such presence and focus and knowledge was a bit unsettling. I really only knew her inside a space of wild, often bitter, always tumultuous emotions. She felt great dignity working at the museum. Working for free, I think, diminished this to a degree. My mother guided me through the exhibit. It helped me respond to the work. My father was exhausted and he was bored. No amount of stimulation, certainly not in this context, was going to pull him out of this state. His exhaustion seemed to me a kind of rebellion. It was a rebellion that kept him ignorant, and yet knowledge would integrate him into a system of subjugation. Beneath the subtext of two interrelated stories, Alan, on the world stage, has a stature comparable to artists whose works are displayed. Out there, bad boy, world transformer. His sense of entitlement, father a poet, even in his defiance, very attached and nurtured by powerful social institutions. Also, over the years, put himself at risk, both physically and psychically. Miriam, young woman with big ambitions, yet confined to very narrow terrain. She was just beginning her academic climb that at 50 has brought her to a place of being almost famous. She comes from an upper middle class family. She's very aggressive, combative, always jockeying for position. But when she's not feeling threatened, she's incredibly generous and responsive to other people's work. Odds more against her than they had been against Alan, though Alan operated on a much larger scale. Her striving looked more harsh than Alan's, probably because his sense of entitlement more secure. But Miriam and Alan move in and out of places of resistance. Alan more fluidly, more securely. He had the run of the museum. The museum, deeply stratified cultural zone. Artists selected, separated as more special than almost all other artists. Work is brought, in this case, to thousands upon thousands of people, there to give pleasure, expand understanding, and secure a structure that keeps people in places of deep insecurity and obedience. Alan is probably one of the few people on the planet who could walk with such ease inside the museum. He was there as an equal. Miriam was, in her way, very obedient to her place, well-educated, curious, intelligent, a deeply responsive viewer. Recently, a friend of mine went with a group of artists with whom she regularly meets to a museum. Work of two well-known artists were being displayed. One who had died maybe 20 years ago, the other was still alive. Each had a floor to themselves. There was much heated discussion about which artist was better. The artists from the group all worked very hard and respect each other's work. There was in the discussion the unstated assumption that none among them would have work that belonged in the museum, and none could question whether or not that type of place should even exist. Well, what does it mean that the separation between them and the artists on display was so marked and complete? My mother, as a housewife, was cut off from the world. She had gotten a master's degree in art history, having gone back to school at 45. But in her mid-50s, she was dying of boredom in her apartment. She began to volunteer in the museum. Her vast knowledge of art history was put to good use. She learned to speak in front of a group. Her confidence increased. Groups wrote letters to the museum praising her for her fine work. But as a volunteer, she was a source of free labor, allowing the museum not to hire someone. The someone could just as well be her, though as a middle-aged woman without a resume, probably not to do the job. So on the one hand, she was brought out of an arid isolation. On the other hand, she functioned as an anti-labor tool. In the museum, my father felt utterly estranged. A man in his 70s, still in business, tired in most places, coming alive when a deal needed to be made, or a political charged subject came up for discussion. An Orthodox Jew, he worked since he was 13. He was there in the museum with his wife and his son. He never deeply resented his wife going back to school. Never resented too deeply what she was learning. He did not in any way try to sabotage her working as a volunteer. But neither was he curious as what she could now teach him. I doubt there was a moment he asked her any question about what she knew, or let himself expand with what she had to offer. He knew very well he was in alien, hostile territory. Still, he could not stretch himself towards her. Robert thinks of himself as a writer, an artist, political activist, feels wildly estranged from the energy in the museum, feels half asleep, bored like in a classroom, physically uncomfortable, resentful. As for his heart beats excitedly as he watches Alan move through the museum, though it aches slightly for a time before he understood how much Alan belonged to the museum. Toward Miriam, there was a feeling of affection and a kind of shutdown sadness for the time they had been lovers. For his mother, it felt a joy for the pleasure she had in showing him knowledge, sharing her knowledge and her ability to appreciate as she showed Robert around with such confidence and flair. For the work itself, she opened his heart to the pleasure of appreciation. For his father, his heart felt pure, unadulterated love, not even a trace of embarrassment. As his father sat slumped on the bench, an old Jewish businessman, wrinkled newspaper hanging from his lap, with all that engaged energy moving in and around him. Inside the citadel of culture, a figure of pure resistance.
I want to thank Chris, Suzanne, and Robert for three fine readings. And I think, well, I know that Robert and Chris have stuff they can sell. Suzanne, do you have anything that you can sell if people want to get something of? Okay, well, at some point you will, so they can. All right, so we take a break, and then we come back. We have an open reading, and we ask for a donation, but we don't attack anybody who doesn't give. So enjoy the break, and make a fuss over our writers, please.
Mike, can you put me on the list?
Yes, of course. I think you're on already.
I'm on already, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Hydrate myself.
Oh, serve me.
I'm going through the big sink. Change
the
history.
But I do remember the times.
Very nice.
I remember. Yeah. And I do write.